Before we get started, dear Americano listeners, I would like to bring your attention to the next Americano Live event. The last one was a huge success, and we anticipate this one will be as big, if not bigger, to get all Trumpy about it. It's Americano Live's Trump's First 100 Days. I will be hosting it, and I will be joined by the great Lionel Shriver. We will be talking about all things Trump. There's a hell of a lot to cover, but we'll do our best to cover the lot. Do join us. It's at the Emanuel Centre on Wednesday, the 30th of April. And the discussion, according to the blurb here, the discussion starts at 7:30 p.m. Book your tickets at spectator.co.uk/Shriver, which is spelled S-H-R-I-V-E-R, as I'm sure you already knew. Please come. Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that. I am delighted to be joined today by James Fishback, who is CEO of Azoria, which is an investment firm, a free-thinking investment firm. And James, we wanted to talk about the Doge dividend, which we will get onto. But given that tariffs are so much in the news today, and we're anticipating tonight UK time, Donald Trump's Rose Garden press conference about the tariffs, I wanted to just start by asking you, as somebody who's interested in the markets, how much turbulence is this causing for you? Do you think this is the upending of the neoliberal economic world order? Or is Donald Trump just pushing extremely hard on the negotiating front?
Well, Freddie, good to be with you. To the question of, is it the upending of the neoliberal world order? I hope so. I hope it is, because the U.S. has gotten the short end of that stick for a long time. And here's the truth. When the Europeans want to buy American cars, bring them into their continent, they pay a 10% tariff. When we want to buy European cars, we pay a 2.5% tariff. How on earth is that fair? So I don't know exactly what President Trump is going to announce this evening, but here's what I do know. It is to reset the global trading arrangement to actually make it fair for once. It's not free trade when your trading partners, in the case but I just mentioned, the EU, are charging you four times the tariff that you are charging them. President Trump, if there were no tariffs on America and our goods and services, there would be no tariffs on any of our trading partners. It's just not fair. And as an investor, I can tell you this. I'm not concerned about what the stock market does on any given day or week, because the stock market is not a representation of the real economy. For far too long, we've paid attention to the stock market and neglected things like deaths of despair, suicides, overdoses, all sorts of metrics that suggest that quality of life in America is worse today than it was when my parents were growing up. And so I think for once, and I say this as a hedge fund investor, someone who's been in this industry for a decade, has made a lot of money investing in markets, tune out whatever the markets do, good, bad, or ugly, over the next couple of weeks. We have to, for once, look at the real economy. The men and women who wake up each day in communities, by the way, Freddie, where they would have, with just a college, or rather just a high school degree, would have had gainful employment in a single household to be able to raise their children. That is no longer the case today. The stock market, put it on the shelf. Let's focus on the real numbers. What President Trump is going to announce today is a reset, and that is to put American workers first.
I take that point completely, and amen to a lot of it. My thought, though, when you're talking in that way, is that a lot of the stock market is the real economy, because so many people are now invested in it, either through their pensions or through retail investors. The bubble of modern economics, in some way, is in another way the real economy, and it will affect a lot of people in the real world, and we're not just talking about the rich here.
Yeah, point taken. About half of American households are invested in the stock market, which means the other half aren't. Don't look at the average number of household investment, because that's going to be skewed by extremely wealthy folks and family offices. Look at the median number. The median number suggests that the average family has maybe $5,000 to $10,000 invested in the stock market, whereas the median household income is $50,000 to $60,000. So think about it. A one-time $10,000 investment in the stock market that might be locked away, by the way, in a retirement account that they can't even access for 20 or 30 years. They're not drawing on that to support groceries or their utility bill. It's this thing that's paid out in the distant future. Or their real income, $40,000 to $50,000 they could be earning at any given point in time. The truth is, President Trump is not apologizing for putting the real wages of Americans first and foremost. And so whether my stock market portfolio here at Azoria goes up or down over the next couple of weeks, I think that's going to be a small price, a very small price to pay for resetting the American economy. And by the way, here's the truth. We have to make a decision here. What do we as Americans value more? Do we value cheap t-shirts and air fryers, or do we value gainful employment for every American citizen with a high school degree? You cannot necessarily have both. If your goal is you want cheap crap from China and Asia, then guess what? You can continue the neoliberal world order and a system that is rigged against American workers. But if you actually want a world in which we are not dependent on our foreign adversaries for antibiotics, for equipment, for chips, if you actually want a world where a young girl in East Baltimore or a young man in East Palestine can graduate high school and be funneled into a manufacturing job to use his or her hands and make $50,000, $60,000 a year, raise that family, then you've got to reject the system of cheap imported crap. Of course, we need a system that works, but the system today is just not working. We have to be brutally honest about that.
I suppose a big question is what the speed at which the American economy, other world economies perhaps, can change towards a more protectionist, to use an overused word, a more protectionist economy. I mean, we've already seen today jobs in America are coming back. Investment to America is inflowing. But this will be a period of turbulence. It will be a time of difficulty, will it not?
It very well may be. And I would consider it to be a period of transition. It is a period of transition. We are taking the economy off of this government dependence. 85% of all job creation over the past 12 months, President Biden's term, was government workers or government adjacent workers in education or healthcare. It's time to make the private sector great again. The private sector, small, large businesses, in whatever industry, in whatever part of the country, should be driving job gains in a healthy economy, not government agencies. And so there's absolutely going to be a transition. If you look at any given monthly job report and say, well, the jobless rate went up for government workers and that was attributed to the rise, then and you're going to get spooked out because some government workers lost their jobs. I understand that's painful. I grew up in the Great Recession. I grew up, my parents very rarely were both employed at the same time. I know how difficult it can be for families. But we have to be honest here. Do we want to let down a couple tens of thousands of government workers who are depending on the government and perpetuating inefficiencies? Or do we want to let down 300 million people with a system that just does not work and is really rapidly approaching insolvency? And so there's always going to be a trade-off here, Freddie. And the trade-off that I think most Americans are willing to make, as indicated by their support for President Trump in November, is that they want to preserve our system and our way of life. And sadly, if that means government workers losing their job, if that means USAID cutting some contracts to Turquoise Mountain and Rory Stewart's wife being out of work for a little bit, then we have to make that sacrifice and we are not going to apologize for it.
No, I think quite a lot of people would like Rory Stewart's wife to be a little less well off.
But it's not personal, right? I mean, Rory Stewart and his wife, I'm sure, are smart incredible, special people, and they will find their passion. But their passion cannot be depending on the American taxpayer's generosity to fund some urinal exhibit in Afghanistan. The people of Kabul don't need that. The American taxpayers don't want to fund it. Enough is enough.
Could I ask, and I'm not asking for stock tips here, although if you want to give them, please do. Where, as the CEO of Azoria, where are you looking for the value now if this great shift is happening in the stock markets, in the global economy? Where is the value going to be? Is it in American companies?
It absolutely. It's in American companies that are hiring the best and brightest right here in America. And here, this is not a hypothetical thing, Freddie. Tesla, I have one, Model 3, it cost me about $30,000. It is the best car on the market, hands down, no questions asked. There's the gas savings because you're charging it at home. It's a fraction of the cost, 90% cheaper than driving an ICE vehicle. Not to mention, driving is an interesting way to frame it because I don't drive it. The car drives itself. I have this full self-driving version 13. I drive my car maybe 250, 300 miles a week, and I don't touch the steering wheel once. I go in, I hit the Siri, I tell it where to go, I put it in full self-driving mode, and it takes me there. It backs up, it reverses, it does U-turns. It's incredible. That car cost $30,000. The truth is, every Tesla that is sold in America is made in America by American workers. If Tesla can make the most advanced car on the planet that just cost $30,000, making it among the best value cars on the planet right here in America, so can GM, so can Stellantis, and so can Ford. And so we're not holding auto companies that are depending on cheap labor and cheap manufacturing in Mexico. We're not holding them to some impossible standard, some hypothetical of what excellence looks like making in America. We're holding them to Elon Musk's standard of what he's been able to do it. And if he and Tesla can do it, so can they. And so to answer your question in a very big picture sense, we are investing in companies that are investing in America. Not because that's the patriotic thing to do. That's all nice and dandy, but I'm an investor at the end of the day. So I've got to compound capital for the folks that we represent. We're doing it because companies that invest in America are going to be benefited on two fronts. The first is they're not going to depend on foreign adversaries. We saw what happened, Freddie, in the early days of the pandemic when American companies had to depend on those imports from places like China when the global economy came to a grinding halt. Their profitability, their sustainability suffered. So we don't have that dependence problem when goods are made here in America. And the second thing is clearly our economic tax regime and the economic tariff regime is now pivoting to benefit companies that hire American and build American. And so when you think about after-tax corporate profits, those will be higher for a company that invests in America, that builds in America, that hires in America, and one that doesn't. And so I think this happens to be the best economic policy. But even if I didn't, I would just look at it and say, company A, like Tesla, is poised to do better under this post-tax regime, given the incentives that are being put in place by the Trump administration, than a company like GM or Ford that is not hiring and investing in America.
Isn't the problem there, though, that we are all living in an impossibly tangled web of interconnectivity between different countries? And you mentioned Tesla there. I mean, I'm beyond my level of expertise, but I mean, where do Tesla batteries come from? We're dealing with companies that are by necessity have to import from abroad, that have complex manufacturing chains that involve different countries. And while I totally understand the logic of all your arguments, it's a difficult thing to unravel.
It is. And look, President Trump knows that we may not be the best in battery technology right here, right now. And we have to create a system that incentivizes that long term. I think to answer your question, when it comes to automobiles right here, right now, the real question should be, where did the vast majority of that assembly take place? Because if the microchip in the car was from Taiwan, but the vast majority of the assembly of the car takes place in Fremont, California, the Gigafactory in Texas, then it is an American-made car. An American-made car isn't one that from top to bottom has every single part and every single bell and whistle that is made in America. It is about a standard that says that for the most part, this is an American-made car. And I'll tell you, when it comes to components, breaking down the individual bells and whistles of a Tesla Model 3, for example, it is both as a whole, but its constituent parts make it the most American car on the market. And so I think companies, independent of tariffs and trade action, companies will be rewarded when they onshore more of their production for the very simple reason, if there is a war between China and Taiwan, and all of a sudden, all of the semiconductors, all of a sudden, all the little parts that make up an automobile are trapped in a global conflict that engulfs the entire world and global trade, then your car company is not going to be as profitable, as successful as one that may pay a little bit more to manufacture that part in America. The best universities in the world are right here in America. The best startups, whether it's OpenAI or NVIDIA, are right here in America. And so I think it's the disconnect between the manufacturing and the actual intellect, the actual human capital is jarring, and we can bring that into closer unison by this trade policy, and we absolutely should. Again, if you want the cheapest t-shirts for $3 at Uniqlo or from Forever 21, then you have to sign up for the neoliberal trade policy of the past 50 years. But if you want to prioritize the dignity and the gainful employment of hardworking American citizens, then you have to really look at the system and say, this is not working, it's time for a change. And whatever you think about him, President Trump is effectuating that change today.
And what you're talking about, I think there is value added. Where is the value added in a product like a Tesla? And it seems to be in America. But then do the tariffs apply on where the value is added, or do they apply on the raw materials? I think that's a difficult question, isn't it?
It is. And this is a question that's going to get sorted out over the next couple of days and weeks as this trade policy comes into the fold. What President Trump announced last week was his 25% automobile tariff. What I will say is that at the end of the day, we need a system that actually looks at the totality of the vehicle. I'm not for a system that says that, okay, the car, 99% of it is made in Mexico. We're going to bring it across the border and then slap some hubcaps on it, and all of a sudden it's American-made car. Mm. Americans know that that is a scam. And so you don't get to make 90, even 80, whatever percent of the car in a foreign country, drive it across the border on some cargo train, and then paint it and put hubcaps on it, and all of a sudden it is proudly made in the USA. This is not about thumping our chest and standing up for the pledge and saying we need American-made cars for the sake of American-made cars. This is about being brutally honest about our dependence on foreign adversaries like China, and being brutally honest about a system that is not working and has not worked for a long, long time. It's time we made American cars for most of our history right here in America. It wasn't until the last 25 years that we deviated from that. And it has not been, Freddie, to the success of the average American. Yes, the stock prices of Ford and GM have gone up, up, up. But the average American's well-being, their ability to afford a home, to have gainful employment, to have wages that keep up with the rising cost of living, that has not kept up pace. And that is the metric, as opposed to share price, that we should look at to determine the success of the neoliberal world order. That has come to an end, and I'm glad to see it happen.
One of the reasons why China has become the factory of the world is obviously because of cheap labor.
Yeah.
And you mentioned AI there. I mean, is the hope among investors like yourself and among Trump world, as you understand it, that perhaps AI, robotics will to a certain extent fill the lower end cheap labor vacuum that will be left by abandoning developing world countries and their labor markets?
Perhaps, but we'll have to see that over a longer period of time. The truth is that AI is coming for journalism, coming for copywriting, coming for low and mid-level legal work before it's ever going to come for a factory worker. We see this right here, right now. The number of software developers, for example, peaked in 2021 online job postings. That's down 85% from its 2021 peak. You're not seeing companies aggressively hire for copywriters, for content developers, for even basic art designers. Now, look, those at the top 10 or 15% of their field, they're going to be okay. But the truth is that a lot of the low-level low-level, mid-level legal work that we do at Azoria, we don't even bother our general counsel with anymore. We just draft up contracts on our own in ChatGPT and send them along our way. And we save that $1,000, $1,500 an hour that would be spent on a lawyer. And so, yes, there is truth that AI and software are coming for labor. There's no question about it, especially things like call centers. But I wouldn't be necessarily sure that the vast majority of labor is going to be replaced is going to be low-level manual work. If you're a carpenter, a welder, an electrician, or a plumber, if that is your profession, you're going to be in good shape for the next 10, 15 years. Yes, there's going to be humanoid robots. We're seeing that with Tesla. It's one of the reasons why it's one of our largest holdings here at Azoria, the Optimus humanoid robot, the real world physical AI revolution that is going to succeed this digital AI revolution, which we're seeing with ChatGPT and image creation and DALL-E and et cetera. But white collar work is going to be going first and replaced first by AI. And that's what we're already seeing. We're going to continue to see that play out. And, you know, we don't want to fight this move toward robotics. It's happening. But I got to tell you that even things like primary care, home care, healthcare, education, teachers, there's always going to be demand for a teacher who stays after class, who sits with that young girl and hears out her frustrations. Perhaps that young girl is tearing up a little bit, frustrated by the math test that she got back. That emotional, empathetic human relationship isn't going anywhere anytime soon. And my advice to folks looking at the labor market now, people, young people who are in high school, who are looking at what profession they want to get in, get one that is AI proof. And if there are jobs that are being threatened, if there's things that you're not hiring someone for today that you're depending largely on AI for, that's probably not the profession you want to get into, just being honest there.
Mm. Well, you mentioned journalism, and I'm sure there won't be much empathy for journalists, but that's a very good point. And perhaps an AI could ask more intelligent questions than I can. But let's go back towards this idea of reciprocity between nations that you were talking about at the beginning. Is that the Trump agenda here? Because there seems to be, from what I can read in Trump circles, some debate about whether reciprocity is the goal. Does America want, if countries established fair trading policies, as Trump saw it, with America, then would tariffs be off the table? Or do you think actually it's really about building up America's industrial manufacturing capacity, which may mean not reciprocity, but something else?
Yeah, there's 2 points to that. Yes, I do believe this is largely a strategy of reciprocity. I think I'll give you the example. I think if President Trump assumed office and there were either 0% tariffs across the border, every country was tariffing us at 10% and we were tariffing them at 10%, again, equal, I don't think there would be this push toward tariffs. That's the truth. That's a reciprocal system. But I also think there's something to be said about our trading partners that are not holding up their end of the bargain in non-economic terms. And Mexico and Canada and China are perfect examples of this when it comes to fentanyl, when it comes to Mexico stemming the flow of illegal migrants that were coming over here. That tariffs can be a strategic tool to get our foreign partners to hold up their end of the bargain. If millions of Americans were pouring into Mexico every single year, if cheap drugs were pouring into Mexico and killing 100,000 Mexicans, 200 every single day from fentanyl as they are to our people, Mexico would have a problem with that. And I don't think they would be sparing in their use of tariffs to try to get leverage and bring a resolution so we can save lives here at home. And so, yes, I think reciprocity is the main goal. But at the same time, when you have trading partners like China pushing out fentanyl precursors to Mexican cartels that are then pouring this cheap drug into our communities, killing young teens, a dozen are losing their lives, and just teenagers every single week, then we can and we should use the trading leverage that's available to us as the world's largest importer and say, if you're not going to secure your border, if you're not going to crack down on the drugs that are coming into America and killing Americans, then we are going to charge you for that to make up essentially all of the both law enforcement and healthcare expenditures that we are, not to mention the lives that we are spending to cover what is a problem of your doing. And so those are the two avenues that we see. We've seen it time and again, by the way, in the first Trump term, when he threatened tariffs on Turkey, when they were not holding up their end of the bargain by detaining an American pastor in Andrew Brunson. We saw President Trump over the weekend frustrated with President Putin threatening a secondary tariff on Russian oil. Those are not about resetting the trade balance and increasing domestic oil production or achieving some economic end for America, but it is about using the leverage that's available to us as the world's largest economy and saying, if you don't want peace, if you don't want to crack down on drugs, if you don't want to stem the flow of illegal, unvetted migrants, then we are going to use the leverage available to us as Americans to get you to the table, to bring an end, and to protect our country.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because there's a debate going on in Britain at the moment about free speech and whether there have been articles about, and J.D. Vance seems to be interested in this idea, that if Britain would be more willing to accept free speech and stop its anti-free speech policies, then America might be more willing to be accommodating towards it as a trade partner. Mm. And that's obviously very exciting to a lot of conservatives. But there's quite a convincing sounding argument from people on the other side who say, do you really think that if Britain announced tomorrow that it was going to stop persecuting people based on their tweets or all the various other ways in which we stop free speech in this country, which are appalling. I think most fair-minded people think that they're appalling, that Trump would suddenly go, oh, okay, you're back in the club. I mean, I think that's probably not the case, is it not?
Yeah, it's not the case. I mean, free speech is a precondition for the rule of law, and the rule of law should be a precondition for a relationship between any two countries. I had the chance to visit the UK for the first time in January, and I was amazed by our cultural similarities, our commitment to free speech, to open debate, to the merit system, notwithstanding, of course, the current Keir Starmer administration, some on the fringes there. Would it be a quid pro quo that if all of a sudden the UK government stopped persecuting folks praying in front of abortion clinics, that all of a sudden there would be some free trade agreement on the table and there'd be the revival of a special relationship? No, it's not that transactional. But I do think that a Labour government reviving free speech, ending the persecution of Christians praying in front of abortion clinics, ending the persecution of folks vetting their frustrations online with the migration crisis in Britain, that would go a long way. It would not be trivial. It would be a step in the right direction that I know that President Trump, and I'm certain that Vice President Vance, would look on in a good way. Would it all of a sudden say that there's going to be another state visit by Keir Starmer and there's going to be a signing of a free trade agreement? Not necessarily, but I do think it would be a gesture of goodwill. And forget the gesture of goodwill. It would be the right thing to do independent of any generosity or goodwill that it would generate. The people of the United Kingdom deserve a government that's going to respect a range of viewpoints. And in the same way our Muslim brothers and sisters can pray publicly, and they should be able to do that, our Christian brothers and sisters should do the same. And as a unapologetic Christian, as someone who's unapologetically pro-life, I want to be able to pray in front of an abortion clinic in the UK, just as I can here in America.
Yes. Well, hear to all that. But just going back to an AI bot would have done this much more efficiently, these questioning, sorry. But going back to your questions on neighbours, Canada and Mexico, it does seem like the immediate upshot of these tariffs will be quite severe on them. And there's some talk in the Trump administration about possibly military action against Mexico unless it sorts out the cartels and so on. I mean, is this a sign that perhaps UMMCA, the replacement of NAFTA, which was a popular move by Trump, and it's something the Biden administration seemed to understand was popular and didn't seek to undo, but that it didn't do enough, that it was actually a bit of a failure?
Well, you know, I would just say that the prospect of military action would not be against Mexico. It would be against the terrorist organizations known as the Mexican drug cartels that are pushing poison into our country, that's killing 200 Americans every single day, that are trafficking millions of migrants over the past 4 years into our country, many of whom are women, many of whom are going to face sexual assault here in America, are going to be pimped out and exploited. And so, yes, if the United States has intelligence that the Mexican cartel is in a particular hideout in some Mexican outskirt community, we should take a real look at using a targeted drone strike against them. Because it's not just to the benefit of us, it's to the benefit of Mexicans. The Mexicans don't want the drug cartels running their country as they do in large parts of Mexico. They want a government that is democratically elected, that actually has control of the situation and security, as opposed to these violent terrorist organizations. And so it's not against the people, it's not against the government, it's against the cartels. We did it in Afghanistan, we did it in Pakistan, we did it without apology. If we know that there is a terrorist organization that is plotting to hurt Americans, whether it's through hijackings or suicide bombings or through the silent killings of fentanyl every single day, that we should absolutely have military options on the table to take them out, because otherwise they'll take us out. To USMCA, that was primarily an economic agreement. What President Trump is doing is broadening it out and looking at the entire relationship, not just trade, not just the economics of bilateral back and forth, but actually looking at, are you contributing to the well-being of Americans? Are you holding up your end of the commitments on sovereignty, on migration, on ensuring that drugs don't come into our country? You know, we can have a perfectly balanced trade situation. We can have no trade deficit with Mexico. But if Mexico is responsible for drugs that are coming in that are killing 200 Americans every single day, that is a bad deal for us. And we ought to renegotiate that deal to include all of the commitments, economic and non-economic, with our trading partners.
But why UMCA? What's it called again? The trade
USMCA.
Deal? USMCA. Yeah. Sorry, forgive me. But that fell short of its goals then, because that was supposed to be the objective of that trade agreement, which would replace.
Well, the objective was, and again, it's not just the letter of the agreement; it's who's actually going to enforce the agreement. And so we had 4 years of the Biden-Harris administration that wasn't serious about righting the wrongs of global trade, righting the wrongs of globalization and how they've impacted Americans here at home. And so it's not just the agreement on paper, it's who's responsible for holding up that agreement. And we did not have good advocates in President Biden or Vice President Harris. Of course, President Trump knows that no agreement is the end all be all. It's about constant enforcement, eternal vigilance. And as the commitments change, as Mexico has clearly been more responsible for fentanyl deaths, if fentanyl deaths have increased from when that agreement was originally signed under President Trump's first term, of course, it makes sense to come back to the negotiating table and have them include new commitments to ensure that Americans are protected.
James Fishback, thank you very much for coming on to the Americano Show. It's been a great pleasure to listen to you.
Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening into it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroz, for doing such a wonderful job. And speak to you next time.